evening pleasure. We're going to have Al sing a song. How was dinner? It was great. I liked it. Anyway, for the next thing, we're going to have our main speaker speak tonight, Scott Westcott. Come on up. I haven't heard him talk that much. I haven't met him before. Everybody knows him.
Thank you very much.
A few other people do.
A few people know me. I don't know if that's good or bad. Really quickly to start off, a few months ago, I received a phone call from Al Pape on my cell phone. Al picked up, "Hey, it's Al. Would you like to be a speaker at the convention?" Sure, I could be a speaker at the convention. I didn't realize he meant the speaker. I thought he meant I could be asked for 45 minutes, a half hour, and take a couple questions, and that's fine. I get the program from the chalice. I remember I looked at it, I called Brian Finnegan. I said, "Brian, I think there's a mistake." Either that or Al asked me to be the keynote speaker. And Brian assured me that I was going to be the keynote speaker. But anyway, it's a privilege to be here. It really is. This is a privilege to be a member of Calyx. And to start off, my name is Scott Westcott. I'm an alcoholic, a proud and grateful member of this wonderful organization we call the Calyx Society. Hi, friends. The people ask me, "You're going to be nervous going up there." Why would I be nervous? Most of you I've known. I got to know last year at the Pittsburgh Convention, and I feel like we're all family. And last year we had a great convention, and this convention is unbelievable. And Chuck, you, Tracy, Stan have done an excellent, wonderful job, and everybody else from you too in St. Paul. And it's a beautiful place, just a beautiful facility to hold a convention. I thought about what to speak on, and I guess people want to hear my story. They think I have a good story, and it's funny. The more you screw up in life, the better your story seems. So if that's the barometer by which we test good stories, I've got a great story. So I'm going to give a little lead here and share my experience, strength, and hope, what I was like, what I went through, how I changed, and how I am today. And as a personal note, I think it is an extraordinary story. From the person I was, the bad person I was, not too many years ago, to the person I'm striving to become. Not that I've become, but I'm striving to become. I'm not originally from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I'm originally from Scranton, Pennsylvania. I wasn't born in a Catholic family. I wasn't born into the CIA Irish family, and I wasn't born into an alcoholic family. I heard my sponsor, who's this Catholic, Irish, and an alcoholic, always talks about the CIA. I was born into neither, or none of those categories. I was born into a middle-class family in Scranton, Pennsylvania. My father's family, Westcotts, were actually founders of the Baptist Church in Providence, Rhode Island, with Roger Williams back in 1638. They moved from Salem, Massachusetts, down to Providence, and was one of the founding families of Providence. My father's family is Baptist. My mother's family, Jakubowicz, are Polish Catholic. And I was born into a family. I'm a middle child of five. My oldest brother is mentally handicapped. My youngest brother is mentally handicapped and was born with congenital cerebral palsy. And my dad was in radio and television in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and he did very well. How I end up in Pittsburgh, it's funny, because my father, from 1969 to about 71, 72, did the morning show on KQV, which now is all talk, but then it was a very popular top 40s radio station. And he had the highest ratings in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He went by the name of Harry West, the Harry West Show. And if you go on KQV's website, you can still hear his jingle from the late 60s, early 70s. I was born in 1964. I just celebrated my 45th birthday. And then it's funny, my sobriety date is December 3rd, 2004. So I haven't even hit 5 years of sobriety. I've been a member of Calyx I'm going into my fourth year in January. And that's why when Al asked me, I said, there's so many more people who are so much more qualified, who's actually been so much more deeply involved in Calyx and in AA. Probably have a lot better things, a lot more experience and to share with this family. But it is an absolute privilege to be here. So I was born into a family with a mentally handicapped brother, a youngest brother who was mentally handicapped, and cerebral palsy. My father was in radio. My mother took time off to raise the family. It was a very strenuous situation because back in the 70s, they didn't have a lot of these governmental assistance programs and schools and for these type of children who were growing up with infirmities and handicaps. So it took a lot on our family. It put a lot of stress and strain on my family, particularly my mother who was the glue of our family. Now, my father's father, my grandfather, who I never met, was an alcoholic and died of cirrhosis. I never met him. My dad never had a drink. I never saw him take a drink, except maybe a glass of wine here and there, because he saw the ravages of alcoholism. He was beaten by his father. A lot of things he never would talk to me about. Our family wasn't a very communicative family. We didn't talk a lot about things. We sit around the dinner table, and everything was fine. My dad was very popular in Scranton. He was very popular in Pittsburgh. But in 71, we moved back to Scranton, Pennsylvania, because he didn't like the big city. And I have no regrets, or I will never condemn my family, my parents, my mother, my father. He chose to go back to Scranton, and he was a big fish in a small pond. Growing up, I was not athletic. I was short. I was chunky. I had thick Coke bottle glasses. I had terrible acne. I was not very popular when I was very young, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old. I wasn't a good athlete. I was a mediocre at best student. I was a dreamer. I'd go out and play by myself and carry a stick and pretend that I was out in the Revolutionary or Civil War. I was always someplace else. I'd read books on World War II and dream about being somewhere in far adventures and being the hero, which I could never be in real life, or I never was in real life. And the one thing about having handicapped siblings is it does teach you compassion. One thing I learned from my brothers is to be compassionate towards all. I grew up in a Presbyterian church. I grew up a Presbyterian. How that came to be, my father's and my mother's best friend was Reverend Mark Thompson, who lived next to them before they were married, married them, and then they just took us to their church. And I was raised a Presbyterian. How did I become a Catholic? Why did I become a Catholic? That's down the road. So I grew up in my formative years not too happy with myself, always dreaming about being someone else somewhere else. My dad was not faithful to my mother. I knew this, but I could never confront anybody about it. And it brought a lot of stress on the family. Finally, somewhere along the line, things started to change. It's called a little maturity. I started to physically mature, and I got a little stronger. I became better at athletics. I became a little more perseverant. I had a little more perseverance in studying and education. But a good friend of mine, who's a psychologist in Pittsburgh and has become a very, very close friend and a mentor and a counselor to me, deals a lot with the men and women who have a gastro bypass surgery. People who are morbidly obese and they staple their stomach and they become very thin. And he tells me about how these people have problems with perception. Because their perception after having the surgery and losing hundreds of pounds, they look in the mirror and still see a morbidly obese person. And that's what transcended through my feelings and how I perceive myself. Even as I matured and changed physically and got contact lenses and did better in school, I looked in the mirror and saw someone I didn't want to be. And people in AA and NA can say, I remember when I first took my first drink or drug. I truly cannot. I can't remember the day I drank. My aunt laughs and they said my uncle, who passed away years and years ago, gave me a beer when I was 6 years old. Well, he may have, but that didn't start my downward spiral into addiction. But I remember when I was young and I started getting better at sports and I started to get hang with an older crowd in baseball and the football teams, and I wasn't even 16 years old, I remember starting to drink. And as it does to everybody, that first drink we feel accepted. We feel accepted by people. It makes us feel like I'm finally home. This is where I should have been all my life. Why and how that does it, I don't know, and I don't think medicine can explain it. But it fills a void, and it filled a void in me that finally I felt whole. And the one thing, as I started to get better in sports and my dad was very popular, I got away with everything. I did not suffer any consequences. In high school, I remember, my parents went out to Vegas, or no, they went on a cruise from the radio station, and I had a week-long party at my house. We had open kegs, all people were coming and going, and the principal actually stopped by my house. And he shut the party down. He said, when your parents get home, you're going to be suspended. Well, they did not. It was football season, and I was playing on the football team. I was pretty good, and there's a game on Saturday. I'm like, I don't know about out here in Minnesota, but in Pennsylvania, football is king, and especially in Scranton, Wilkes-Barre, and Pittsburgh's probably worse. So they were not going to take a chance at losing a game on Saturday at Abington Heights. So I never had one consequence. I never was suspended. I was never had a detention. Nothing. And my life went on and on like that. I ended up going to college. My parents were still together. My dad was still cheating on my mother. I ended up going to college at Syracuse University, where I was pretty good. And I played a little sports up there. And again, I never studied. I partied, and I skated through college. But I did well enough. I had no consequences. And that is not a good way to go through life. We're talking here at the Kalis Convention about spirituality and praying. That was so foreign to me. I didn't grow up in a Catholic school. I didn't have catechism classes, CCD. I didn't go through that. I did what minimally I had to do. I went to church on Sunday, the Presbyterian church, went to youth fellowship. Even there, I ran amok. I manipulated, I did whatever I wanted to do. It was self-will run riot, but I didn't understand that at the time. I drank, I partied whenever I wanted to. In college, the same thing. In 1982, I graduated high school, though, and I was wondering what I wanted to do with my life. What was going to be my career? My parents, one thing we did is we went to Williamsburg, Virginia, every year, every other year. I was big into history, and I saw a movie called The Verdict. Anybody remember The Verdict? Yeah. Paul Newman, great movie. Paul Newman's an alcoholic attorney who sues the Archdiocese of Boston. It's a medical malpractice case. And he has this case so screwed up, for those of you who didn't see it, he's going to lose this case. He turns down a $300,000 offer without telling the family. He finally has to take this case to trial without star witness, Caitlin Costello. I could still remember her name. If you remember that case. And what a movie. At the end, the jury comes back in favor of Paul Newman and the family, and they said, they only asked for $1 million, but can we give more money than they asked for? And I said, that is what I want to be, Paul Newman, the lawyer. Not the drunk lawyer, the lawyer. And as the old saying goes, be careful what you wish for, because it may come true. And I wanted to be Paul Newman in The Verdict. Not the drunk, but the successful attorney who wins a case for the little guy. So I went to law school. I went to law school at Syracuse. Again, skating through. Not putting forth a lot of effort. I always tell people, I kept pulling rabbits out of my hat. I don't know how I did it. And it's funny, sometimes I wake up today from a dream, and I dreamt that I was 3 credits short of graduating law school. And I think it is because I don't think I ever deserved the things I obtained. I think things came easily to me as life moved on, moved forward, and I don't think I ever deserved what I got. But believe me, in the end, I got what I deserved. You can only pull so many rabbits out of your hat so many times, and sooner or later, the hat's empty. So I went to law school, and again, I had a principle and a theory that I didn't think I should have to go to class before 10 o'clock. The great thing about law school In college, you have pop quizzes, you have tests every couple weeks, and you have to somewhat, at least you can't BS everything. You've got to somewhat prepare. In law school, you have one test in December and another test in May. That's it. And maybe a writing assignment here and there. So I thought I really died and went to heaven. I could not do anything for 3.5 months and then cram and get by. Well, it worked because I didn't go to class too often. I go into the final exams, people were saying, who are you? I kid you not. And I did well enough. I did well. Actually, it's funny, in constitutional law, and I'm not saying this to pat myself on the back, but this is why I kind of thought law school was kind of a joke in the end. I didn't go to class, but I did like constitutional law, and I did read a lot about it. I had an outline. It's the open book test in law school. You don't have to go in there with the knowledge up here. As long as you have a good outline, you can BS. And so I had a constitutional law class. In December, I took it, took the exam. And I had a great exam for some young lady who I manipulated into getting her, who went to every class and did all the outlines and studied, read every case. And I got this exam, and I gave the biggest BS answers to these questions I could ever come up with. We come back in February, first the grades are posted. I went upstairs to the cafeteria. I looked for my number, and it said, highest A. I went down to the cafeteria again. I said, you have to be kidding. It was literally the highest A in that class. I could not believe it. And when I walked down there, I told my friends, law school is a joke. That's what I thought about what I was going through. I was taking no pride in what I was doing. And the funny thing is, I got the highest A, but then I decided to study. And I knew every case. When it came to the final, I got a C. So I ended up with a B for the class. I couldn't figure it out. And I realized sometimes it being more creative and just winging things pays off sometimes when you become too rigid in your thinking, like I ended up doing down the road. So as I was nearing another story when I was in law school about how I never had to deal with any consequences. I just broke up with this young lady, and my brother, who was going to the University of Scranton, a good Jesuit school up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, called me. He was into the Grateful Dead. He said, Scott, what are you doing for the next 10 days? Well, I'm in law school. He said, we're going to Miami to see the Grateful Dead. I said, give me 2 hours, I'll be in Scranton. So I drove down from Syracuse, and I took off to go see the Grateful Dead in Miami, Florida, with my brother. Now, my brother, who's still kind of, he lives out in Bellingham, Washington, north of Seattle, he's still a little bit, well, in a hippie mode at 43 years old. God bless him, he's a great guy. And he's got over 10 years of sobriety. I know he wouldn't mind me saying that here today. So I get down to Scranton, and he has a 1969 Volkswagen van. We're all dressed out and decked out in tie-dye, and I'm like the least tie-dye person. I mean, at that time, I'm weighing like 240 pounds, big, muscle-bound, decked out in tie-dye. We started off great. We started off going 75 miles an hour. I can remember every state we hit, we lost 10 miles an hour somehow. There were some flaws in that, in the engine of that 69 Volkswagen bus. So we finally got down to on the Savannah River in Savannah, Georgia, and we blew a head gasket. So we somehow limped into the airport, the Fulton County Airport, the Georgia, right over the Savannah River. And we rented a Cadillac. And so we put all of these tie-dyes, and we end up making the 7 o'clock Grateful Dead show in Miami, Florida. And so here I was a raging alcoholic at the time, but then couldn't accept that. And my brother gave me these little pieces of paper, and I started eating them. I said, what is this? He said, Scott, it's LSD. Well, that was not a good mix, me being an alcoholic. And everything I had to do was 100% when it came to pleasure. And it was the first time I tried LSD, and it was a unique experience. I never tried it again, but it was very unique seeing things grow out of. We end up going down to Key West after the concert, and it was just, there's a Grateful Dead song about stars falling from the sky, and I understand what Jerry Garcia meant when he, and Bob Weir meant when he wrote that. So, But I came back to law school eventually after 10 days of my excesses. And I come back to law school all nice and tanned and feeling good. And a couple students said, "Scott, they're looking for you." I said, "Who's looking for me?" They said, "The dean." There were notes up, "Where's Scott Westcott? Tell him to report to the dean's office." So I go up to the dean's office. And unfortunately, there was a project due that it was one of these weak projects he had to do and crush in this one business course that I was taking. And I was in Syracuse. I was down enjoying myself, what I thought I was enjoying myself, following Jerry Garcia and the boys. So the dean comes up. He says, "Scott, we have to release you from Syracuse University Law School. You missed the last 10 days. And maybe he said 2 weeks. I don't even remember exactly what it is. So I looked at him and I started literally crying. I welled up tears and I started crying. And he asked me, "What's wrong?" I said, "Well, I was in Florida. My uncle who raised me," this is the BS I could give, "my uncle who raised me died and I was working on his house. That's why I'm all tan." And I literally broke down in tears because I was being kicked out of law school. One thing I really wanted to do. The dean looked at me, came over to me, hugged me, said, "Scott, we'll take care of you." He had me write a paper, like a 5-page paper to make up for this project. Another thing, another way I manipulated every system I could get into, and I came out what I thought was ahead, because then it seemed like it was ahead. But all that manipulation, all that BS catches up to you. I don't care who you are, if you're Bernie Madoff or who, the guy, you know, running numbers on the street. It all catches up to everybody. The funny thing is, even in law school, no one said, "I think you're an alcoholic. I think you have a drinking problem. I think you should go get help." I never could understand that. No one ever said, and I don't know if it was my personality or what it was, or I don't know. I don't understand. I never could understand that looking back. So I ended up going to Pittsburgh. My family finally was divorced. My parents were divorced. My mother moved out to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to be with my sister who was living in Mount Lebanon, which is south of Pittsburgh. And she, her divorce attorney at the time had cancer and she really got a raw deal. I remember that I was doing the briefing for this guy in Scranton and I didn't realize he was dying of cancer at the time. And she signed the paperwork and ended up in Pittsburgh. So I left Syracuse, but I didn't leave out. I didn't go after 3 years. I decided to hang out for one more year for my MBA. I was having just too much fun. I didn't want the party to end. I didn't want to face reality. We actually have to start getting up in the morning, going to work, and answering to people. Because for, at that time, 25 years of my life, I really didn't have to answer to anybody. I didn't want to answer. I manipulated people, and I thought I was ahead of the game. So I stayed for my MBA. I finally went back to Pittsburgh to help out, be with my mother, who I dearly loved, and my sister. My brother was out there at the time. He was going to get his MBA at Katz Business School in the University of Pittsburgh. And I started working with a relatively large firm in Pittsburgh. And I did well. I didn't drink Monday through Friday. I had these principles. I mean, what I thought were principles, but I had these guidelines. I would not drink Monday through Friday. But come Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock when the old bell sounds, everybody's out, the whistle blows, and everybody's jabba-dabba-doo, homeward bound. I was off to the bar. And sometimes I went to the bar, I had one or two drinks, and went home. Sometimes I had one or two dozen drinks, and the party lasted all weekend. And unfortunately, I would always get behind the wheel and drive, because it was my mentality that I can do whatever I wanted to do and get away with it. And that pattern continued in Pittsburgh. I remember I was on Wood Street going the wrong way on the bus line. People in Pittsburgh know where that is. And the signs, when you're drinking at Froggy's all day, which is a bar that was very potent drinks, one drink would get you tanked. Drinking all night at Froggy's, you're going up to Wood Street, you don't realize you're in the bus lane going the wrong way. The police pull you over. "Well, yeah, I think I have a DUI. Well, I talked my way out of that one. The young lady, police actually drove me home to my apartment, parked my car on the side street. That happened not once, twice, maybe three or four times. Well, I was pulled over for DUI, and I talked my way out of it. "Oh, I'm an attorney, I'm gonna lose my license. I came up with this sob story." And it worked. Finally, however, I was down in, and Joe McGurin might know this, when did the Phillies play the Atlanta Braves? What was that, 1993? I was in Atlanta, Georgia. My friend, Dad, was play-by-play announcer for the Philadelphia Phillies, Andy Musser. And I was down at watching the Phillies and the Atlanta Braves play in 93. Well, I was in Buckhead. Anybody's been to Buckhead? It's a party town. I guess it's north of, on Peachtree, north of Atlanta. And I was pretty tanked, very tanked, drunk, out of my mind. But for some reason, I wanted to go get a hot dog at one of these convenience stores. Well, Peachtree Drive in Atlanta is lit up in the middle of the night like this room is. And that was back in 93, they didn't have those automatic headlights that turn on, and you have to turn it on manually. But it was so bright out, I forgot it was 4 o'clock in the morning. Well, I pulled out, and right away, the red, blue lights, I believe in Atlanta, blue lights were flashing in my window. Well, I didn't put up a fight, I said, take me to jail, I'm drunk. Well, in Atlanta, Georgia, they don't accept a Yankees BS as well as they do in Pittsburgh, I guess. Well, needless to say, they took me to jail, and this is the first time I actually knew what it was like to experience racism and prejudice against myself. Not, it was funny, I was the only white person in the jail. It was Atlanta City Jail. I was the only white person, no white workers. And I realized, I finally had an understanding of what it felt like. I had to realize I was dressed all in polo, very preppy, and there were some mean looking people down there. But it was an experience. But what I did was, I didn't accept responsibility at that time. I didn't accept what was happening to me. I used my brother's name. I said, I'm Jeff Westcott, not Scott Westcott. And where's your license? I don't have it on me. So they arraigned me, they went through the whole process as Jeff Westcott. Now in 1993, they didn't have the interstate computer system where they could check everything and do the fingerprints right there and never come back. And that was my first criminal offense, actually. And my brother at that time had no DUIs. So they booked me under Jeff Westcott. He never lost his driver's license, came back. At that time, I paid a $700 fine, walked out the door, had to go back down in a couple months to do an 8-hour driver safety course using his name. I mean, I went to the sentence. I got sentenced that day, then went to the course. And the judge says, well, do you have your ID on you? I said, no. I don't have any ID. He said, okay. That's how lackadaisical back in the early 90s the system was. So I get back to Pittsburgh. No one in the firm, no one ever knew I had a DUI. In all this time, I'm living what I thought was a good life. It's funny how perception is so skewed sometimes. We think what is good is dismal. I met a girl at the St. Paddy's Day Parade in Pittsburgh. We were both crushed drunk. A few months later, I asked her to marry me, and we were married in 1995. At that time, I left this firm, and I started my own practice, Self-Will Run Riot. I didn't have to answer to anybody at all. Made my own hours, had a client come in, I'll make sure I wasn't hungover or drunk. Things went from bad to worse. But I was still what I thought was a big deal, big wig. Wearing nice clothes, driving fancy cars. But really, it was all on paper. It was a shell. Nothing was real about myself then. Sad sometimes we have to waste so many years of our lives to realize the person, people we really are. So I married this girl, very, very wonderful young lady. Her parents were alcoholics. I was in the throes of my alcoholism. I never could communicate. I wouldn't talk about anything, nothing. I was clammed up. I was stoic about everything. That marriage lasted about 9 months, which is... And I remember I came home one day, I was out with a buddy of mine buying a new car. I came home and the house was completely empty. And she wrote me a long note. I ripped it up and flushed it down the toilet without reading it. I remember after we talked about it, about the wedding, she said, Scott, you make the greatest husband, the greatest father. You're a great person, but I don't know who you are. I don't know anything about you. And I said, screw you. I am who I am, and I'm happy. I thought I was happy with myself. I'm going to continue my life. But we were divorced in 1996. I lived my life. I was out in Colorado skiing every year, going down to the Keys, going to South Beach, Miami, living in the New York City. As fast as I made money, I spent it. I have a client come in, give me X amount of dollars. I plan a trip to spend X plus one amount of dollars. It was just a sick, insane lifestyle. In 1998, I got my second DUI. I remember I was coming home from, my brother and I were drinking in this bar called Heaven. If anybody from Pittsburgh remembers a bar in Heaven, down in the old Renaissance Hotel now. But I was pretty tanked. And I was going up Polish Hill, and this car stopped short at a yellow light, and I hit some gravel, and I rear-ended her. Well, she came out, we exchanged information. 6 days later, I get a call from Zone 5 Police Department. They said, we have a warrant for your arrest. I said, who the hell is this? This has got to be a friend of mine. I hung up. They called me back. They said, you call us back at this number, whatever, 5-6, whatever. The police department, I called back. And this says, yeah, this is a sergeant. There's a warrant out for your arrest. At the time, I didn't practice criminal law. I knew nothing about the criminal justice system. I was doing civil and corporate law. And I didn't realize that this girl's testimony, I thought, okay, they have this girl's testimony who worked at a bar said I was drunk. That was the evidence they had. But I ended up hiring a friend of mine who was a civil attorney, knew not the law, and we ended up pleading the case out, which at this time, being a criminal defense case, I would have tried that case in a second. But at the time, I didn't know criminal law. I didn't know the proof, the burden of proof. I didn't know that was, but I pled the case out, and I had my second DUI. I was sentenced to 48 hours in the county jail and 65 days house arrest. Well, I couldn't do 65 days house arrest. I had a trip planned for Aspen in 42 days. So my buddy, the DA, I said, listen, Joel, cut it down to 40 so I go on my vacation to Aspen. Okay. My first experience in the Allegheny County Jail, I never left the cell. I went into the jail, took a book, never went out. I was scared, blankless. 48 hours is nothing. I mean, that's all I could do is standing on my head, as they say now, when I hear these defendants. If I never walked out of the cell, one of the guards was a neighbor of mine. He'd come in and give me food and bologna sandwiches, but it was a miserable experience. I went on house arrest, came home. I was still driving my motor vehicle while I was on house arrest. I parked it 2 blocks away. I didn't have my driver's license. And I got off in 40 days, and I went to Aspen, Colorado, and life was good. Went out there, drank. That was fine. That's the last trip I made to Aspen, Colorado. Because even my friends who were drinkers, who were much older than I, said, we can't handle you. You're just too crazy. But I thought it was fun. Drinking hard, getting up and skiing hard, drinking hard for 10 days. When I was in, that was in 1999. When I was in Colorado, my mom was having stomach illnesses. We didn't know what it was, She called me and said, oh, I went to the hospital, everything's fine. I called her from Aspen. I'm like, great, I'll see you when I get home. Finally, she wasn't fine. On March 24th, 1999, she was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And we've all seen the ravages lately. It seems like it's a disease, unfortunately, that's been very prevalent. Patrick Swayze, if anybody followed that professor at CMU who had the last lecture, who died of pancreatic cancer, what an inspiration he was. But I didn't know what pancreatic cancer was, and I'm an optimist. I've always been an optimist. And I said, well, beat this. Now, we had a doctor who was a foreigner who didn't speak English, and talk about no communication. He would not say, your mother doesn't have long to live. I remember we planned in June a trip to go out to Las Vegas. She loved to go out there and play the slots at the Flamingo. I remember that. But she was too sick, and she was in the hospital having more surgery. And I really went into a severe depression. And when I was depressed, I didn't have a wonderful fellowship of AA or Calus to call people and go and have coffee with and cry with. And I found my solace going to be around people in the bars and the clubs and hanging out with people who drank. So I went to... I was golfing at the country club I belonged to at the time, and I got really hammered, and I was pulled over for my third DUI. Well, I was on probation for two DUIs. It was in June, before we were supposed to go to Vegas, which we canceled the trip. It was a Tuesday night, and I was tanked. It was my third DUI. Well, I went to the jail. They took me down to the jail, and the people in the probation, so I started doing criminal law at this point. I gravitated to criminal law after my first, second degree law. And the people at the jail knew me in the probation office, and they said, there's going to be a detainer put on you. We got to get you out of here. They were actually helping, what they thought was helping me out. They got me out there on an OR bond on my own recognizance. I went home, and there wasn't a detainer put on me. Probation detainers, when you're on probation, you violate probation, they detain you in the county jail until they have a hearing. Well, they didn't put a probation detainer on me. I had my preliminary hearing scheduled for city court, and I kept putting it off. Finally, they said, no more postponements. August 3rd, you've got to come down and face at the preliminary hearing and face the charges. I went down to city court, and I waived it. Same attorney I had who just passed away not too many months ago. And I waived it. They came up and put me in cuffs and took me to Allegheny County Jail for a probation violation. And I didn't know what a probation violation was because I was still new to criminal law. I didn't know all the ins and outs. Well, I thought I'd be out of there within hours, days, a week. They took me in that jail, and they stripped me down in the old body searchers, and they put you in these res, and they take you upstairs, and it's not a pleasant experience. And I found out that I wasn't leaving there very soon. Enough was enough, they were saying. And my judge, Judge Novak, who I cursed at the time and I thank today, gave me a very harsh dose of reality. I was sentenced there, and they wouldn't let me out of jail, basically. I had to face these charges. I had a detainer. And on August 31st, while my mother was dying of cancer at home, the correctional officer came to my cell door and knocked and said, Scott, I got some news, some bad news. And I said, oh, they denied my petition to get me out of here. He said, no, it's worse. Your mother passed away last night. And the funny thing is about that night I had a dream that my old neighbor from Clark Summit, Pennsylvania, outside of Scranton, in a dream said, your mother's going to be okay, who passed away herself from cancer a few years before. And I dreamt that, and I woke up. I said, that was the oddest dream I've ever had. When Mrs. Bianca came to me in a dream and said, your mom's going to be okay. My mom died that night. Well, Judge Novak, he was a good guy. He is a good guy. He allowed me out to go to the funeral, gave me a 7-day furlough, and then he allowed me to go to the renewal center. We buried my mother, we cremated my mother, Mike would be happy. She's interned in a Lutheran church. but his Pastor Pedersen was a good fit with my sister and her family. Good to my mother through her trials. My mother was never, she was Polish Catholic, she was brought up Polish Catholic, but she was, I know that's not a great excuse, but she was so tied up with two handicapped brothers, mainly handicapped brothers, it was difficult. And one thing I left out, my brother, cerebral palsy, passed away in 91, which was put a little strain on the family, a little sour note. It was very difficult to deal with. We were in Pittsburgh, he was up in St. Joseph's Center, good Catholic center up in Scranton, Pennsylvania. You think I would have learned 3 DUIs. My mother passed away when I was in jail. My career was in shambles. You think I would have learned. I would have come to my senses and said, what is wrong with the picture here? But I went to the renewal center and went right to my ways of manipulation. A bunch of 21-year-old, 22-year-old kids said, we have an attorney in here, a big wheel attorney in here. So I took him out drinking with me. I'm in the center that I'm supposed to be a prisoner in. I'm drinking with the guys who are supposed to be watching me, the monitors. And it went on and on and on. Finally, it was Super Bowl night in 2000. It was, I went out to a little club in Pittsburgh, took all the guards out with me, and we got too drunk. I knew they were going to be working. They were supposed to be working when I got back at 11, 12 o'clock at night. I got these guys too drunk, and they were too drunk to go to work that night. I walked in the renewal center, and there were people there I never knew. And they wanted to urine test me, and I laughed at them and went upstairs. Well, 3 days later, I was in the Allegheny County Jail. Because again, that's not acceptable behavior when you're a prisoner. I know that sounds odd, but they don't like you going out and drinking with the guards. Can you believe that? So I stayed into the Allegheny County Jail until May 9th, 2000. And that was the year, Joe, you'll be happy. I remember listening on my little radio, the hockey games were going like in five overtimes, the Flyers. Do you remember this? But I got out on the 9th, and lo and behold, on the 9th, the Flyers were playing in Pittsburgh. My buddy got tickets, and I went to the Mellon Arena, the Civic Arena at the time, and I ordered an Iron City beer. Is that insanity? I remember I picked up that beer and I saw a dim reflection of myself in that beer. And I said to myself, you're sick. The first time I can actually tell myself, you are sick. Put the beer down. Didn't drink that night. The next day I got a call from the disciplinary board of Pennsylvania, the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, saying I had all these charges filed against me it's hard to go to court when you're in jail. They don't allow that. Have you come over from the jail to go to court. And this woman said, why don't you call Mark F.? He's head of Lawyers Concerned for Lawyers. So I went to Lawyers Concerned for Lawyers on the 11th, it was a Thursday, the 11th of May, 2000, my first AA meeting. And I went there, and I was my obsessive compulsiveness. I grabbed every book, every literature, read, memorized how it works, you know, everything. And I became the voice of what I thought the Lawyers Concerned for Lawyers. I had everything memorized. I knew everything. And I was talking the talk. And it sounded good. People would ask me to speak at their meetings, do all this extra work for them, and come help this guy out. But every Friday, I was drinking Captain and Cokes at happy hour. I was drinking in a big, tall glass. So people said, what are you drinking? I said, Diet Coke, Diet Pepsi. I was talking the talk. I was not walking the walk. Again, I wanted to be perceived as having myself together. But there was a time, I remember, I sustained a period of 9 months sobriety at one time. And the funny thing is, life started going pretty well for me. But you know what? We get bored easily. I get bored easily. There wasn't that excitement. I wasn't digging myself in holes and getting them out of there. I wasn't getting myself behind the eight ball and pulling myself out and pulling rabbits out of my hat. It was life I thought was boring. That was boring to me. Actually going to work, going home, doing normal things that normal people do. There was no excitement. So I went back to my old ways pretty quickly. And I remember I'd drink at these bars where all the attorneys hang out and the DAs hang out. And I knew after about two or three Captain and Cokes, a big 20-ouncers, I had to get out of there because I was probably slurring my words. So I limited to two or three, and then I'd head down to the other bars where no one really knew me. I was living this double life. However, that didn't last long, because in January 2001, I got another DUI. I'm sorry, it lasted about a year. January 2002, I apologize, I got another DUI. I was going to a friend of mine who's a public defender's 50th surprise birthday party, and I was pretty crushed. I was drinking and driving. I had no driver's license. I did what I wanted to do because it was what I wanted to do. God wasn't even a concept in my mind. Although I go to the Presbyterian Church every once in a while and go there just because it looked good. They have some noon 25-minute sermon or something down there. I went there because there were some attorneys I knew. I wanted to impress that I was doing the right thing. Finally, I get thrown in jail. I'm sorry, that was 2001. My story is so convoluted sometimes I can't remember my own screw-ups. That was in 2001. And then in March, I went to anybody place knows a place called Father Martin's Ashley? Judge Zatola, Court of Common Pleas, realized I had some serious problems. So what he did was sentence me to go to inpatient rehab at Father Martin's Ashley. And I was talking to Mike today at dinner, we were talking about guest house, how nice it is, and I went into that place and I said, this is like the Palm Beach Polo Club. Chandeliers, beautiful glass overlooking the Chesapeake Bay down by the Susquehanna River. I told my friends, the one thing they don't have here is an open bar. If they had an open bar, I'd be in heaven. Well, I was given another break by allowing to go to Father Martin's. Father Martin just passed away this earlier this year. You think I would have learned? No. Again, I manipulated the system. I broke every rules. I broke into offices to use the phones when I wanted the phones. I hung out. You're not supposed to hang out with females. Well, I did. And I was given two or three warnings. Finally, I was almost sent back to jail. But they let me go. I didn't. That's in 2000, 2001. I wasn't sober until 2004. They let me go. I went back to jail, and I had a sentence because I have now multiple DUIs. I gave the name of the cop a false name. I had all these charges. They sentenced me. Judge Dower, who was a good friend of mine, a good Irishman, who once said to me, he's passed since, and he said, Scott, I'm an alcoholic too, but it's too late now. He was in his 70s, a great guy. He sentenced me to two consecutive 11 and a half to 23 months at a halfway house, at the Ark House. Well, I didn't want to go to the Ark House. So I said, Judge, I gave him an order of court. I said, let me go to the Rebus House, which isn't a really approved halfway house, but let me go there anyway. Okay, because you're my buddy, Judge. Give me a break, another break. So I worked it out with this guy at the Rebus House where I never showed up. I pay the money, but never go. So the DA's office was getting on to me. They knew I was a manipulator, conniver. So they ended up going to Reba's house and realizing I wasn't there. They call the Aspen Mall Police Department to check me out, and here they come down the corner, and I'm driving my car with a DUI suspended driver's license. Well, they pull me over, and they took me back to jail. So they take me back to jail, and they send me to Mayview State Hospital. Mayview State Hospital is for the criminally insane. I wasn't insane. My God, do those things sound like someone who's insane? Of course not. But Dr. Martone, I knew she was being nice. She said, well, I think we should get you out of here, out of the jail, and maybe send Dr. Christine Martone as a head psychiatrist in Allegheny County. I said, let's take you to a place to get you some help. So they sent me out to Mayview State Hospital, and I was out there with a lot of murderers. A lot of people hacked up their family members. And it's a very odd experience when you're sitting there watching a hockey game with somebody who is a former attorney who just gunned down five or six people in Pittsburgh. And it was odd. Well, they diagnosed me as this, that, and another thing. And they finally, the judge said, well, we're going to let you go. We'll let you out of Mayview, and you're going to go to another place, Alekiski Pavilion up in Arnold, Pennsylvania, which is north of Pittsburgh. You could finish your sentence there. I said, okay, perfect, sounds great. So they let me out and go up to Alekiski Pavilion, and I wanted the same privileges I had at the renewal center when I was drinking with these guys. I wanted to come and go when I pleased, and I didn't expect any constraints or restraints, and I expected free rein. Well, unfortunately, this gentleman said, no, you got to work from 8 to 5. Now, at the time, that took me all the way into 2002. In 2002, into June, they suspended my law license. June 19th. So this is the next month in July 2002. I didn't have a driver's license, but I wanted to go to work at the law office. That is, again, insanity. So he said, you must be back by 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock at the latest. Well, I said that wasn't good enough, so Judge Gallo, who was my judge at the time, I took an order of court and I signed his name and said, nope, this is what we're doing. Well, when you sign a judge's name to an order of court and you give it to someone in basically a prison, I don't know what they call it in Minnesota, but in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, it's called forgery. So I forged Judge Gallo's name to an order of court allowing me unlimited access to and from this halfway house because I wanted to. Well, that didn't go over well because the halfway house realized it wasn't Judge Gallo's signature. They called the DA's office, they put a warrant out for my arrest, and I was on the run again. So what did I think I was going to do? Here was my plan. I'm going to go out to a ski resort and stay at my friend's condo and then somehow get to Paris, join the French Foreign Legion, get a new ID, and come back to America in like 7 years. That was my legitimate, my plan. So I paid a cabbie $275 to take me to Hidden Valley Ski Resort. And the next morning, the sheriffs, I guess I wasn't a good planner, the sheriff somehow caught up with me from three different counties, came back, arrested me, sent me back to the Allegheny County Jail. I had a $100,000 bond. That's when you make the big time, when you have a $100,000 bond on you. And I had multiple detainers, and I wasn't going anywhere. And I had an 11-count indictment for forgery, escape, use of a communication. I faxed the order of court to the halfway house. I had an 11-count indictment, and I wasn't going anywhere. Well, finally, enough was enough. I sat there through 2003. And I finally went before Judge Novak. And in 2003, they knew I needed help. I went back to Mayview State Hospital again for some more corrective work, shall we say. And quite honestly, that was, when you don't have counseling and you just get pumped up on medication, that doesn't do anything. People who are in that field, pumping someone up with Zyprexa, Depakote, lithium, without therapeutic cognitive counseling is really a waste of time and money. So I ended up going in front of Judge Novak, and he said, Scott, you manipulate everybody. You know the people in the county too much. I'm giving you a state sentence. I'm giving you, because you're not going to mess with the state boys. And it's true. They're a different level. So he said, Scott, I'm giving you a first of all, it was a 1 year to 4 year state sentence at the Allegheny County Jail. Then he reduced it to seven months to 4 years. But it didn't matter because it just manipulated the effective date and ended up being a 1 to 4 anyway. But I stayed in that Allegheny County Jail day in and day out, waking, eating crap for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and really thinking about what I was going to do. Now, somewhere along the line, I'm here, I'm a Catholic. Somewhere along the line, I started to pray. You know, of all my life, I prayed to what I thought was God. Because what I wanted, get me out of this, God. Get me out of this, God. I promise I'll never drink again. And I thought he didn't answer my prayers. He made me face the fire time and time again. And looking back, he answered every prayer. He made me go through what I went through. To change. To find God. Find the true meaning of God. Had he let me go time and time again and answered what I thought was a prayer, what I thought was a soulful request to petition him for what I wanted, not what I needed. What I wanted, I wouldn't be here today. I guarantee you that. 2002, at the Allegheny County Jail, I met this nun, Sister Toni Dombrowski. Back in 2002, she's still alive today. She's in her 90s. She's a sweet woman. She started coming to my jail cell, handing me out Catholic literature. Sit with me and talk to me. And one person at that time in my life saw some good, a spark of good in me. For the pathetic person I was, there was one person, an 83-year-old little nun who carried these bags every day with underwear, pencils, T-shirts, little trinkets for the inmates. Spent her own money. Saw some good in me. Saw something of redeeming quality. And I started to read about the Catholic faith. And I realized I was supposed to be a Catholic. My Polish Catholic background, it drew me. The Eucharist drew me. The Masses drew me. I started attending Mass. I started to just absorb as much as I could, not because I wanted to be impressive or make myself look good. I found solace in the relationship I started forming with God. I started to go to the Mass, and there was a gentleman, Brother Mark, who's my sponsor today, who got me really involved and sit with me and speak to me about the Catholic teachings and the principles. Another gentleman who attended last year also met Brother Mark and Deacon Tom O'Neill, another man who was very, very powerful in my confirmation, my conversion to transformation in the Catholic Church. And in 2002, in November, I was baptized and confirmed in the Allegheny County Jail by then Bishop Earl of Pittsburgh, who's now the Archbishop of Washington, D.C. And it's amazing because things started changing. I felt a change with that confirmation, with that transformation. I found a whole new set of people, a different whole aspect of my life that I could be my start being myself. I got out of that church. I got out of the jail finally in December of 2003, and I had to go to a 90-day Department of Corrections halfway house. This isn't the one you can manipulate. These are real deal. I went to a 28-day program where this this tough old black lady, Delphine, was the real deal, and she'd stamp up and down and say, home or homie? Where do you want to go? You want to go with your homies or home? And I learned more, because that's what I need to do, is been beat on the head by the, and not some posh, it wasn't working for me, these posh rehab centers that I made it big time. I needed to face reality, where my life was headed. And I finally got out, and I had nothing. I had lost all my money, lost everything. I had to use county assistance for my medical, for food stamps, to get myself back on my feet. But I did. I started working for a law firm, an attorney, as a paralegal, making very little money. But it was more money than I was making in the Allegheny County Jail, that's for certain. A lot more money. I could feed myself, and I remember I got out of jail, and there were days I went without eating. And I thought about taking food from the store. And I said, you know what, that is not the right thing to do. Starve if you have to, but do the right thing. And I started to get involved with I thought it was the right people, but there was a problem. You know, I tell people in the jail, I go back to the county jail, and I run the meetings on Monday night now, and I say, there's people, places, and things, but the people take you to the places and things. If you're going to hang out with the same crowd you hung out while you were drinking and drugging, you're going to be back in the same bars you were in the same situation. And I didn't understand that back then in 2003. Because I still had pride. I couldn't go, and I wasn't as open with Brother Mark and Deacon Tom and the people I am today. I still had too much pride. So I went back to the group I was comfortable with, the group I knew. They knew I was in trouble, and I wasn't drinking with them, but I was going to the same bars. I didn't get it. I did not get it. And sooner or later, I drank for the last time, God willing, on December 3rd, 2004, and I violated my state probation. I was sent back to the county jail for 6 more months. And then when I was in jail that final time, in the Allegheny County Jail, Lord willing, that's the final time. Deacon Tom came to me, and again, people met Deacon Tom last year at the convention. Here's a gentleman. I'm going to give you a little background on Tom O'Neill. Tom O'Neill is an attorney. Tom O'Neill founded a terrifically successful company in the 1970s called Black Box. I don't know how much Tom O'Neill made out of that when they went public, but I know he could probably do anything he wanted for the rest of his life, anywhere in the world. For the last 24 years, Tom O'Neill goes to the Allegheny County Jail every day and ministers to the inmates. To me, that is the person I strive to be. He's not on some island smoking a big fat cigar. He's not in recovery. But that is the humility that I find people who take our faith seriously. Brother Mark, another guy, a Christian brother, works at Central Catholic High School, who's my sponsor, runs a halfway house, a transitional house for men who are coming out of jail mostly and trying to find sobriety. But Tom O'Neill came to me and said, Scott, if you're serious this time about getting your life together and recovery, I'm going to give you my number, and when you get out, you call me, if you're serious. I took his number, put it in my Bible, and on June 7th, 2005, I was released from the Allegheny County Jail. I walked out of there, again, not having anything. I did have my job because the attorney accepted me back, because I violated for drinking. There was no forgery this time. But I actually, for the first time in my life, and I kid you not, really, I took a direction. I took direction from Deacon Tom, and I picked up the phone, and I called him. He says, here's your new sponsor, Brother Mark. I want you to call him. And all this time, my law license wasn't even a thought. It was done. It was gone. I was going to be disbarred. There's no doubt about it. I was losing everything. But I wanted what they had. I wanted what you had. The peace and serenity, the tranquility to live life how we live it today. And so I started taking those baby steps back and back. I remember I needed help. I left the jail. They had me all this medication. And it's funny how God, there's a master plan. And God does provide if you allow him to provide. You know, we heard Father Talbot talk today. You know, it's God who's in control. You know, we're not reaching out to God. God's reaching out to us. God knows it. You know, I hear that thing, when the student is ready, the master will appear. The master's always there. God's always there. It's when we just have to open up and pray and ask what we need and ask him to give us what we need and pray earnestly and request earnestly and open our eyes to what he gives us. Brother Mark directed me to a gentleman, Bud O'Brien, who was a retired psychologist at Michael's Place and volunteering with the Michael's Place, the guys who were in the transitional house. And he started meeting with me. And he said, Scott, I'm not going to be your psychologist. I'm not going to be your counselor. I want to get to know you. And then after I get to know you a couple months, I'm going to refer you to someone I feel you're going to do well with. So I started meeting with Bud O'Brien every Saturday. We sat down, had a sandwich, coffee, and talked. Finally, in December, he said, Scott, this is throughout the fall, the end of the summer and the fall. He said, I think I have three people. I think, you know, I've done as much as I can do. Now you need someone you can really delve into and really communicate with. So here are three names. So I get back to the office. I call the first name. Now I'm on public assistance, and he didn't take my insurance. The second guy, Dr. Paul Friday, took my insurance, and we set up an appointment. Now, Dr. Paul Friday is a chief clinical psychologist at Shadyside University of Pittsburgh Medical Center in Pittsburgh. He was a former teacher at Central Catholic. He was a swim coach at Central Catholic, where Brother Mark is a brother. And it's funny how the first guy I called wouldn't take my insurance. The second guy, who knew everybody I was associated with in the Catholic Church, the Catholic faith, happened to end up being not only my psychologist, but my confidant and a close friend, who I consider a close friend. And I see him, Dr. Friday, every week to start off. And I would tell him, you know, and first of all, he started talking about, you know, it's psychology is a great, I love the way the mind works. But he sits down and said, well, what's your family like? And the first thing I said, I'm tired of blaming other people. It's not my mom, my dad, my brothers, sisters, it's me. And he said, good, I'm glad you said that. Now we can start working. And Dr. Friday was a very insightful person. And he really stuck by me. Even when I was up by insurance, they wouldn't accept his charges. He kept seeing me. And he saw me time and time again. I saw him as of February 24th, my law license reinstatement. I think he said I saw him like 72 times in 3 years. But Dr. Friday gave me a lot of insight about how I should live. And if you look in our literature that Chuck passed out and Dan passed out for the, it talks about the 2 days. The two days of the week we can't even worry about. And there's something in life that I learned about called the stations. Stations, not the stations of the cross, are stations in life. And this is how I lived. It was always tomorrow. I was looking for tomorrow, the next week. And I think a lot of us in the throes of addiction live this way. We don't live in the here and now. We can't wait to when we graduate high school, when we graduate college, when we get a big car, when we get that big job, when we get our big promotion, when, life is going to be great. We don't realize that the journey is what we have to enjoy in life. And that's how I was. I couldn't wait till I get back home. I couldn't wait the next week and go windsurfing. I could never live and just enjoy the moment with here today at the Cadis Convention in St. Paul. And I've learned to live that way. Although not perfectly. Because I still sometimes, I have to admit, I'm looking for getting my law license back. But that's down the road. But that's how I've learned to live a little bit. And a lot. The funny thing is, though, when I would pray to God, and I look back, he actually gave me what I needed in every step. A lot of painful memories. Being in jail when my mother passed away, it was painful. I don't wish it upon anyone. Having to go through incarceration being the scholars, the pariah, the legal world in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I don't wish it upon anybody. But today, I'm happy who I am, to come here amongst friends and be comfortable without having to worry about drinking, about who I am, and embarrassed about my past. You know, what's the saying that goes, the two thieves in people's lives are the regrets of yesterday and the fear of tomorrow. That steals today. And I've lived that life. What I do now, besides being a member here, is I go back into the jail. Every Monday night, we take the meetings back. I know Marlene and Ned do it. I know a lot of guys, people here, go into the jails. And that is where we're going to find the next Calyx members. I know we talked about the hospitals and institutions. You know, Christ went out and he chose the disciples, not the wealthiest, not the judges, not these successful people, but the outcast of society. And I was an outcast of society. And sometimes I feel like I am still, but in a good way. And when we go back into the jails, we're talking about building Calyx, getting younger people in here. It's not easy. And I was talking to someone today, I might have been talking to Mike. You know, getting involved in Calyx, it takes a maturity, a spiritual maturity, I believe. Coming out of jail, and I speak from experience, you're really grasping at straws, in a sense. You know what you have to do, but you're looking for that solid foundation. Now, I don't have the answers how to go in and get people out of the jails and into Calyx. But I think we're starting to put in place in Pittsburgh a decent mechanism by having Brother Mark in there, Deacon Tom. And I know I've got to deal with the chaplain at the county jail. Because for some reason, Deacon Tom says, you give them all literature and nothing shows up on the shelves at the Mass. And we hear about how some of the priests in some of these parishes don't want to accept Calyx or don't want to allow us to provide them the gifts we can. And it's not easy, but we have to work on that as a Calyx society. I believe we have to really start thinking through things, and I think Amy and Ken in Philadelphia have done wonderful, wonderful work, and they're such a new unit and such a tremendous unit, and they're an inspiration to us in Pittsburgh. I know that throughout the whole society. And what kind of group is this? We have wonderful, wonderful people. And I just want to thank Jim Billigmeier and Jerry at the international side. Those people are unbelievable. And it's funny because I think Brian Finnegan said either they're devoted or they have no life. Brian, I think they're devoted. I don't want to go on and on, but it's funny about the society. It's funny, it's amazing in AA. We come from all walks of life. We have all educational levels. We come from different parts of the country, different ethnic backgrounds, but we all end up here in one room. With the grace of God and Calyx, today, back in Pittsburgh, they're signing off on my petition to return to the practice of law. They have their annual disciplinary meeting. And I could not have come this far. I could not be here today. I need to keep moving forward in my life. And you've been a wonderful experience. You've been wonderful people. And I consider you family. I hope I didn't bore you too much tonight. God bless you and thank you.